before there were hashtags.
A dissection of pop culture past.
With Eric Dallinger.
And Carly Anna Billings.
Each week we hop in our time machine and take a look at the past of pop culture. Hey guys, I'm on the Before There Were Hashtags podcast. I am your guest, Eric Dallinger, and I'm here with the wonderful Carly Anna Billings.
Hi, it's me, I'm here!
And if you can't tell, we're recording together!
We're together in the same place, bah, 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 for the very first time coming at ya. You're welcome, hooray!
Oh my goodness, I'm so grateful for the nice weather and the loosening of the restrictions slightly.
Yes.
That we can finally meet in person.
Yes!
I need to speak up though, because the mic's a little far away now! But maybe my sound's better, because somebody was complaining about my sound.
Spicy. Drama.
Spicy.
So spicy. Why is it spicy?
Carly, how are you?
I'm doing good, Eric. Thank you for asking. I am excited things are changing where we live. Things are moving. It means that more people are getting vaccinated. It's an exciting time. It's summer, finally. Full-fledged summer, and I'm very excited about that. And, just grateful to be here sitting with you, and, like, what a time it's been. How are you doing, Eric?
I am doing all right. I'm doing good. Very happy to be here. The two-week break was really nice. Big things happened, as in I turned 24.
Yeah, you did, young baby. Young little child baby.
Turned 24 years old.
The youngest ever.
I am 24. I'm so excited to be officially in my mid-20s at 24.
You have the face of literally like a 14-year-old though. So like, who are you? Like, you're not even kidding.
I know.
You are. You
I'm 20. Well, I turned 28, friends.
You might as well be though. 24.
And my
14.
Beautiful friend, Carly, got me the two best, sweetest gifts.
Oh my gosh.
So I got a lip scrub from the Lizzie McGuire makeup collection.
Yes, I did. ColourPop. Come on, come through.
ColourPop.
Come on, collab. That was a great tongue pop.
That was a pretty good tongue pop.
That was really good. Resonated.
And I got the game Uno BTS edition.
Because they make that. Someone came up with that. There had to be so many teams involved to make it happen. It just makes me so glad that I could give that gift to you. Because it was, when I saw it, it made me just giggle forever. It exists. Amazing.
That's what, you give really good gifts. My last birthday, you gave me a Drag Race tarot card set.
I did. Oh, that's true. Oh my gosh, cards theme.
Yeah.
Wow, 2 years
You love your games.
I love
and
a
you
game.
Love your pop culture.
Well, I'm nothing if not consistent. That's for sure.
Consistency is key.
It's key.
Yeah, so it's been a good break.
That's good.
You know?
Yeah, all the things.
I'm so excited to be outside.
Yes.
I think I've said that already.
But, like, it goes for another saying. It's a good time. It's nice to be here.
It is. All right, my friend. Well, maybe we should talk about what is currently going on in the pop culture news.
Ooh, are you suggesting we gas up our time machine to go back to the way back?
What?
Are we doing our very first segment on our podcast? Finally? It's been 2 weeks. It's like,
I almost forgot it was a segment.
Oh, baby, it is a segment.
What is this thing? Gassing up your time machine?
What? Well, in case you've forgotten, our dear listeners, this is our little segment that we do before we head into our topic of the day. And because our topics of the day are always, you know, from the past, hence our name, before there were hashtags, we like to take 5 minutes at the top of each show and gas up our time machine so we can go back to the way back and talk about current pop culture in order to gas it up. So I think we should set 5 minutes on the clock.
All right. Here we go. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Okay, what's in the news this week, Eric?
Well, All-Star 6 was announced. That's RuPaul's Drag Race All-Star 6.
Yes, recently. That's totally true.
So, both of us are Drag Race fans, so we are very excited.
In case you can't tell.
That being said, we are a little Drag Race overload, because we are
currently
in the Down Under season. Down Under. Mm-hmm.
You've opted in and I've opted out of this one because I just can't take it. I get that it's Pride Month. I get that it's exciting. But Down Under, it's too many for me. So I've opted out.
Well,
but
why don't we start with six? I'll start six.
Sure.
Some amazing queens have been announced.
Amazing queens. Iconic queens. Queens that you're like, how you're back again. Okay, good for you.
Jan Sport.
Oh, love her.
Akira Davenport.
Yes, a party.
My personal favorite and my choice to win if I could.
Yes.
Trinity K. Bonet Brown.
Yes. I'm excited for the Minge herself.
The Minge.
Ginger Minge.
My prediction, like, right here is Ginger Minge wins.
Do you really think we'll have a big girl win? Like, you think Ginger will win?
Yeah, you know why I think Ginger is going to win? Is I think that a lot of people would say that she was robbed in...
the last time she was on All Stars?
No, when she was on Seven.
She was robbed, like, on Seven. She was up there.
She was top three with Pearl, who we knew wasn't going to win.
No, but we love Pearl.
We love Pearl, Pearl's but we knew Pearl wasn't going to win.
No.
And Violet Tchotchke, and let's be real, I didn't really think Violet should have won. I mean, she's the most controversial winner in terms of...
She is.
In terms of should have at the time. Yeah. I know that there's some Sharon Needles, Tyra Sanchez drama that
totally.
A lot of people... But I mean controversial in the fact that
the
they
time.
Won.
Yeah. I really love Violet Tchotchke. I think... I can see why people don't agree with me, but I think she's so beautiful and stunning, and her burlesque numbers are through the roof. I just can't get over that bad bitch. I love her, even though she won against the person I would want to win above all, Ginger Minge. Ginger Minge is my glamour toad of my heart. Ginger Minge is who I want to be. Have you seen that bitch freaking sing, what did she sang, what's that song from, oh my god. She sang it on tour. It's the best. Oh my god. Anyways, I'm gonna kick myself because I know we're running out of time, so I don't want to take up more time trying to figure out what it is. But
so yeah, my prediction is Ginger win, and then also a kind of a redemption for All Stars too, because I think.
Yeah, totally.
I think a little bit. I love Katya, but when it was between Ginger and Katya, I think it should have been Katya that went home, even though...
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, because, at the time, Katya had the weakest... she did the weakest in the challenge. Or at least that's what the judges said, and then Alyssa sent Ginger Minge home instead. So,
well, because as a competitor... Justice for Ginger, but as a competitor, at that point, Ginger was, you know, the weakest. I love the Minge. I'm here for the Minge.
I don't know.
Oh, the Minge. Okay, the song I'm thinking of, for some reason, it popped out of my head. I Am What I Am. This bitch sings I Am What I Am, and it's the best thing I've ever seen.
Did it pop into your head, or did you look it up on your phone?
Well, my phone is an extension of my head, so what can I say? How's my head? It's my phone. Thank you very much for asking.
And then there's also been some Down Under drama, so, yes. The joke is that RuPaul accepts, oh my goodness, is there a cat out here?
No, there's... Hello?
Sorry, we've been visited by a cat.
You don't live here. That's okay.
Aww. RuPaul famously got mad at Joe Black for
wearing
H&M.
But, no, H&M.
But seemed to be okay with Scarlett Envy doing blackface.
I mean, right? Like one of these things is not like the other.
I mean, look, you could...
Who did blackface?
No, not Scarlett. Oh, sorry, not Scarlett Envy.
I was going to say, I don't think Scarlett Envy did blackface.
What's
Scarlett
her name?
Scarlett Envy is so cute. Scarlett Envy's on All Star 6,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, sorry, mixing my
That's
season
why.
Up so
you're
much.
Just, you've got All Star 6 on the brain. But yeah, one of the queens from Down Under. Yeah, for sure.
It was Scarlett. Their name is Scarlett. I'm just mixing up the last names.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know, like, I don't know how I feel about her being on the show still. I get people's critiques, and then I also think that if she had been kicked off for it, she would have kind of become a martyr for it, and some people would have been...
Well, the thing is, like...
Scarlett Adams.
Oh,
sorry.
There we go. Scarlett Adams.
I don't know.
Well, the thing is, like, RuPaul is really a stickler on things like when someone is a predator, and then they get, you know, canned, but then somebody does blackface and they don't get canned. Oh, there it is. Yeah. It's just interesting times, for sure.
I'm just saying I'm glad it wasn't my decision.
Yeah, we're glad that we're not producers on that show. We're just producers on this show. And you know what we say goes here. And that's a good thing.
So, Miss Carly.
Yes.
I am very excited to talk about today's topic, our first topic back.
As am I. This is a very exciting topic. I also think it's a very, topical topic because of the release of a new series on Netflix recently, Halston.
Yeah.
So,
have I talked about Halston on the pod?
I think you mentioned it. Yeah. I recently watched it during a break, and I was obsessed with it. I'm obsessed with it. I want to watch it again already.
Halston.
Because I love Ewan McGregor. I think Ewan McGregor is amazing. And the whole time, I couldn't take my eyes off of everything that was so beautiful. I love vintage. We love old things. We all gather this and grasp this. But I thought it was great. And so, of course, our theme today is the legendary, the one of a kind, the only Studio 54, friends. Yes. Yeah.
Very disco.
Very disco. Disco made us do it. We can't help it. So I just want to start off with I did a lot of my research for today by watching. I mean, I watched Halston. That's just for context for my own brain. That doesn't count as research because it's fake as hell.
Yeah, it's highly fictionalized.
Highly fictional. It's really fun. Really
Ewan
fun.
McGregor's great.
Ewan McGregor's beautiful. But what I did watch for research on Netflix is an awesome doc, which came out in 2018. It's called Studio 54. So
yes, I watched the same documentary.
Because it's the best one.
So you could just turn the pod off right now and go listen to and go watch
just
the
go watch
documentary. Yeah. No. There's more information about the we did further research, so we found some previous stuff before.
Ooh, you're welcome.
But Carly, before we start, can I ask you a really serious question?
Sure.
It's really dark up here. Can we turn on a light?
Yeah, 1 second.
I'm going to sing to you while we wait for Miss Carly to turn on the light. She is knocking at the door, waiting to get in. Her dad just closed the blinds on her.
Can you turn the light on? It's so dark out here.
It's so dark. Oh, the light doesn't work, friends.
Do you have some matches for the candles? We're dying out here. It's too dark.
I'm so scared. It's so dark and scary.
We're gonna get haunted.
Ghosts are everywhere. This is our new podcast, Ghosts Are Everywhere.
Welcome.
Just kidding. That's Carly's other podcast. Go listen.
Okay.
We're back,
oh,
friends.
Oh, girl. Okay.
That was
ooh,
a trip.
Grace.
I had to press pause because we were taking too long.
It was really a lot. Okay, can you see okay?
Yes, I can see okay.
Okay.
So, getting into the start.
Getting into the vibe. So, the thing about, the reason I brought up Studio 54, the documentary, so early is because I wanted to start us off with one of the first sentences they start the documentary off with because I thought it encapsulated the vibes so well. It really stayed with me. So, here it is. When you walked through those blacked out doors, you were in another world. Come on! Ain't that the
yes.
truth, though? I mean, apparently, we weren't alive. But from what I gather, that sounds about right.
So let me start off by just talking about the building a little bit. So the building was designed by architect Eugene DeRosso. I'm going to take that again.
Yeah, go for it.
So the building was designed by architect Eugene DeRosso in 1927, and he is a famed architect. He built 44 different theaters, mostly in New York and the New Jersey area. So many of the Broadway theaters that you have seen or been to were designed by him, or at least they are inspired by him, because a lot of them have been knocked down.
That's true.
It was called the Gallo Opera House, and their first opera was La Boheme by Puccini. This time it really was Puccini. Remember last time when I thought Carmen was Puccini?
No. La Boheme is really Puccini. Can vouch for that.
Hashtag rent.
Hashtag rent. Aw, we've been in that together.
We have been in rent.
It was also after it was an opera house. It was later a CBS TV and radio station.
Yeah.
Dubbed Studio 52.
Yeah. So it became the New York Theater, and it had a slew of failure. So it eventually yes. went belly up in 1940. And then, 3 years later, CBS bought it. And they turned it into Studio 52. Mm-hmm. Which, why is it called Studio 52 and not Studio 54? Mm-hmm. It's because they didn't name it based off of the streets it was on. It was the 52nd studio that CBS had had.
Totally. Yeah. It had nothing to do with the fact that it was located on West 54th and 8th. That doesn't matter. It was just about, what... the number that CBS had established at that point.
Yeah, and certain shows had been filmed on that stage, such as What's My Line, the $64,000 Question, mm-hmm. Password, and Love the... Sorry, mosquitoes okay. are out here. The mosquitoes are getting us,
they're
friends.
Getting us.
The soap opera...
The citronella that I turned on would
yeah.
help.
The soap opera Love of Life was filmed at that TV stage.
Totally. Yeah. Like, honestly, quite a lot of, very popular shows. Like, Password? That's one of the most popular game shows of the 70s.
Yes.
Yeah.
I famously more know it because SNL makes fun of it all the time.
I mean, same. But the thing that they're they're spoofing it is because it was popular.
Mindy Elise Grayson.
Yeah. So... It wasn't that for too long, and then then it's the time that we're talking about.
Yeah, we're gonna get into the big things. Yeah, so I also wanted to talk a little bit about the birth of disco. So
sure.
The creators of Studio 54 were very heavily inspired by the kind of disco era that was happening, and disco was black music mm-hmm. and was also gay club music.
Yes.
So they were very much... I haven't even said their names, so we'll get there.
We'll get there.
We're circling around. So they would go... Disco became popular largely. The documentary talks about this. Is that these gay fashion designers would often bring their models to mm-hmm. these gay clubs
yeah.
to listen to disco.
And to dance and have fun.
Yep. And then straight men started coming to the gay clubs because...
They wanted to pick up these models.
They wanted
women.
To pick up the models.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, it's not much different than today. Like, a lot of, straight or straight-ish women befriend, gays. They go to a lot of bachelorettes go to gay bars when they go out for their bachelorette. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It is a bit of that culture of, straight girls are safe here and it's fun. So it makes sense that, they wanted to go where the good music was, which was disco at the time. And they wanted to have fun because disco, the whole spirit of disco in a way at this point was very freeing. It was very, inclusive in a way that other styles of, music and clubbing hadn't yet become.
Yeah.
And it was only going to become bigger, better, more wild, more inclusive.
Exactly. So the creators of Studio 54 were Steve Rebell, and he was Brooklyn born, and he was very inspired. He played tennis, so he would often go mm-hmm. to these houses belonging to very wealthy people in upstate New York in order to play tennis with these rich people.
Because tennis is for rich people. And he grew up middle class as well.
Yeah.
So he had a peek into that world, but he wasn't of that world, per se.
And he really wanted to be a part of it. And so
totally.
He was very persistent on the idea of making it rich.
Yeah.
And then
absolutely.
He started a steak restaurant. It yes. didn't really work out.
No, it didn't go well. Because also the thing about Steve Rebell is he was very charismatic. And he just, I think for him, he also he was gay. And
yeah.
so he...
And very extroverted.
Very extroverted, very friendly, very fun. He ended up becoming... This is going a bit ahead. He was the face of Studio 54. He was, the guy that, got and kept the party going, He's kind of like the host with the most kind of vibes from Steve. And he... Yeah, he started steak restaurants because he was like, this is something I could do. It'll be fun. But it didn't go well. But he had this friend... named Ian Schrager, who's also from Brooklyn, who he met in college, and also grew up middle class, much like Steve. But Ian, out of college, became a lawyer, and because Steve's steaks restaurants were failing, he had Ian help keep his creditors at bay, so Ian became his lawyer. And Ian was this straight man, middle class, like I said, from Brooklyn. And he
was also the son of a mobster.
I know. I was waiting. I was trying to figure out if this is a good time to mention.
Yeah,
it.
He was also the son of what's his name? Louis. How do you pronounce the last name? Sorry, Schrager.
Schrager, I think.
Yeah, Louis Schrager, who was also known as Max the Jew.
Yeah, which is like, hello, that's a problem. But because he was like, was he not the an accountant?
Yeah, he was accountant for mobsters.
For mobsters. So, I mean.
That sounds so problematic.
Well, that's a huge problem, but that's what they called him. And,
He was reclaiming it.
He was reclaiming it, I guess. But the thing is, Ian didn't want anything to do with his father's business. So that's why later on, it might come up that people thought that Studio 54 had ties to the mob. But really,
exactly.
In reality, they didn't. It was just that Ian's father, that was his line of work. But he didn't want that to be his line of work, apparently. But these two men, Steve and Ian, after, you know, Steve's restaurants are failing, Ian kind of gets them out of a bind. They, like, work well together and they're friends. They decide to become partners in, you know, the nightclub scene because they both kind of have something to prove. And they both kind of go into it thinking, we're going to do something big.
Yes.
But their first, hold on.
Sorry, I made it sound like I was going somewhere. I was like, yes.
Yes. It's okay.
Everything she said is correct.
So before they started Studio 54, if we can backpedal just a year, in 1976, they started a club called Enchanted Garden.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
And it was like the prototype, and it was like for the Queens kids. And yeah.
For young people, they like threw like parties, like bar mitzvahs and stuff like that.
Yeah, and it was known for having like this really kind of beautiful, kind of crazy ambiance to
it. Totally. And like the clips that I've seen from it are like Steve's like yelling over the mic, like, are we having fun? Like stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Host with the most kind of vibes again. And it's very like, not rough around the edges. It's very like not what Studio is, but it was very, you can see how doing that, having the experience in that business was able to propel them to the success they had later with Studio.
Yeah. So they eventually, do they buy or rent? I forget.
In 1977, I believe they buy.
Yeah.
They buy it, the building. Because at that point, it's
An abandoned theater.
An abandoned theater, you know. Just at it, like I said, at West 54th and 8th. In the theater district, but at that time, the theater district was, and I quote, where you go to get murdered in those days.
Yeah. So it wasn't. That's like, actually a really interesting thing about New York is like Times Square is considered this really touristy, really clean, kind of family friendly area.
Yeah. Like, where locals don't go.
In the great words of Miss Saigon, call girls are lining Times Square. It's the American dream, right? Like, New York was gritty. New York was not. What it is today. It wasn't a tourist attraction. It was a gritty place to be.
And in the 70s, it was like there was so much clear. I mean, there is still so much poverty there. It's a huge city. There always will be. Unless that gets fixed. Let's fix that. But
like so much class division.
Totally a lot of class division, but also just a lot of like vacant lots, a lot of poverty, this is the time when things like guerrilla gardening starts happening, where like hippies like start throwing seed bombs in like vacant lots because there's just garbage there. And
right.
So they try to like this is a time of rebuilding. People are trying to rebuild communities around New York City throughout all the boroughs because and this is the 70s. This is when a lot of white families have left for the suburbs. Like, that happened through the 50s and into the 70s. And then the people who are left in the cities are the poor. So it is a lot of, like, not only abandoned places, but, like, disenfranchised folks. And just, and then crime gathers. So because nobody lives in the theater district, at least at this point, people live there now.
And
not like to the extent as other neighborhoods, because it is, again, the entertainment district. It was a place where it was like, if you don't go there, people don't go there.
Yeah.
Right?
If you wanted to get murdered, you went there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so
it was a weird place to establish a nightclub, like just a club in general.
But it also made it probably affordable.
It definitely made it affordable.
And they also, they didn't totally redesign it because part of their aesthetic was that they wanted to build a place where the dance floor was a stage. By coming onto the dance floor, you were becoming part of the show. But they did have to lower the raked seating that was in the theater mm-hmm. and have to build booths. And they built a belt. Well, they didn't build a balcony, but they had to outfit the balcony.
Yeah, totally.
Exactly. And this was a huge undertaking.
Yeah. So the whole thing about the building of studio is super interesting because really they built it in, this is ridiculous, but they, not only did they risk establishing it there, but then they also decided to build it in 6 weeks. So they built all of Studio, the first version of it. They did a lot of it with, like, unbridled DIY energy. They didn't wait for permits. They didn't, like,
wait
for anything important they needed. They just kind of started going and just, like, let it happen.
They put in permits and then prayed that they would come after they finished building.
Yeah, because they had to start, like, putting in the floors, like you said, changing the rigged floor to, like, a more regular dance floor-ish and seating area, or they wouldn't have it done by opening. And, like, they also, the way in which they went about creating this atmosphere it was very unique with the people they brought in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I was also gonna say before, it was in the 70s, it was really hard to get a liquor license.
Yeah.
So they didn't think they were going to be able to get a liquor license for opening day. Mm-hmm. So they decided that instead they would get a catering license. So for like an event liquor license rather than an establishment.
You get it for one day only.
Yeah, you would get it for one day only. However, this would maintain for years. They would just go every day
to get a catering license. Oh, it's just such a big joke. Like this, like, it is true to me. It is astonishing what they were able to accomplish, and the fact that people just kind of let them do it, because this is one of those stories where it makes me go, we can do anything. Like, anything's possible if two random guys can make this thing happen. I mean, they did have help, of course. They had a silent partner as well, but like, it's still just like, the idea of, like, act first, like, ask for forgiveness later.
Yeah.
It feels so contradictory to me that the whole spirit of this was that. But look at what they accomplished. So maybe we gotta act more, ask for forgiveness later.
Yeah.
Maybe that's really a good takeaway. But, so not only, like, were they doing DIY and everything, the way that they came together with this set, who they brought on to build it, and by this, I'm calling it a set because it really was a show. It was a theater. Like, this was a piece of theater, honestly. Like, it was a nightclub, but it was, like,
they made it snow inside and stuff like that.
They brought on, at first, Paul Marantz, who of course, won a Tony, and he's a theater designer. They brought in mostly people from the theater, from the Broadway world, because they're the people who were able to get the show on the road, kind of thing.
Yes.
So Paul Marantz was a lighting designer, and yeah, they had literally no unions. Like, they didn't have time for unions. They didn't have time for any of this. They just were like, come and do it, please. And so everyone just kind of went, okay. The effects were, like, there was basically a set design. Everything was done to a Broadway scale, but it was for a nightclub. So it's like,
yeah, so
it had never been done like this before.
They hired Scott Bromley as the architect.
Totally.
They brought on Ron Dowd as the interior judge. I can't talk.
The interior designer.
Oh my goodness. It's been 2 weeks, friends, and I've lost my ability to speak.
It's difficult out here in these mosquito-infested outdoor streets.
And Brian Thompson as the lighting designer. So yeah, they had this full-on, almost borderline theater show that they wanted it to look. They wanted to incorporate the theater into the design.
Totally, because at this point, like, nightclubs, they're a dime a dozen. A lot of them, especially like the gay clubs and things, they feel kind of like how I guess you would think a speakeasy felt in the 1920s. It was very underground. It was very secretive. But they wanted to take all the things that they had been enjoying in the nightlife and bring it on a bigger, better, like, fully realized production scale. And so that's what they did. And the documentary, Ian Schrager, says that originally it cost them about $400,000 to put together. But then his silent partner, who's beside him, I can't remember his name. I didn't write it down because he's a silent partner. He wasn't, like, the face of it. he ended up saying, actually, it was more close to $700,000. And Ian was like, what? And he's like, yeah, we owed the contractor money, and then I had to pay it later. Like, so it was a lot. They shelled a lot of money to get this done, you know.
Yeah, it was an expensive, expensive deal that they had. Totally. They needed to make it work.
You got to make it work. And so, you know what? It ended up working out because it was, like, the first night was total pandemonium.
Oh, yeah, they didn't have, they kind of invented the velvet rope. Mm-hmm. So many people wanted in. They were rushing the door. They had to bring all the security that was in the building
outside.
And they just had to pray that nothing crazy happened inside because all the security was outside.
Yeah, just to control, like, the throngs of people that were there and excited to, you know, be there for the first night. Literally, it was so busy that people, as they got in, just threw their coats at coat check. Like, people were not, there was no organization. It was full, like, you walk in, you hear the thumping music, you just, everyone just flooded in. It was apparently incredible. At, like kind of we've alluded to, it was almost like anything goes when once you get in those doors. It was the spot, it was the place where you go to be with the people that everyone wanted to be in a room with.
Yeah, that kind of brings us to the next point of they eventually put up a velvet rope, and the people that they would let in. So it's this weird paradox because on one hand, all types of people were let into Studio 54. It was very inclusive in the sense that gay people, straight people.
In the spectrum of people that were allowed in.
So many people were allowed. Drag queens. It was very accepting and open. And then at the same time, it was a little bit of an Abercrombie and Fitch situation where they would only let in the really beautiful people. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I guess if we're going off this Abercrombie and Fitch rule, I suppose that we both would have been able to go into Studio 54 because I was able to shop at Abercrombie and Fitch growing up. Just saying.
Yeah, but were we asked to work at Abercrombie and Fitch? No.
I mean, got me there.
That was always my goal growing up, was to be asked to work at Abercrombie and Fitch.
I don't want to be taught enough to be an Abercrombie and Fitch boy. I love that. So yeah, it was the getting in that was proved the most challenging. They let in people basically who they liked based on their vibes, their looks. They had a list at the door, and on their list would be a lot of celebrities because it's a huge celebrity hotspot. We'll get into some of the names there in just a second.
Holston.
Oh, Holston. But they're on the list, though, was different celebrities, and they were all, they had something next to their names. They either had the word pay, the word comp, or the word NFU, which is not to fuck up.
Yeah.
So it was for the doorman. It was for, oh my god, what's his name? I have it here. It was for Mark Beneke, who was out front. He was the door guy, and the reason he became the door guy for Studio 54 is because he was their hottest security guard. No other reason. He had no experience. Oh, hello.
Hello.
He had no experience. He just happened to be their hottest security guard hire, so he became the doorman, the front man, the guy who let people in.
There were also people that were told they were never going to be allowed in. Totally. There was like a no enter list.
Yeah, and that the other thing that could be beside your name was NG, which meant no good, which is so funny. And that would be for celebrities too. Like so they would let in some of the Rolling Stones for free, but some would have to.
Mick Jagger got in for free, but yes. The rest had to pay.
Yeah, and it's just like it's so arbitrary. It's so funny to me. And the people especially not allowed in was the bridge and tunnel crowd, which would be the people outside of the city who would come in from, you know, New Jersey and the suburbs and elsewhere.
It's like when people from the 6 complain about the people from the 905.
Yes! Oh my god, that's so true. And, you should talk about...
That's a Toronto reference.
for all of our locals, that's a good one. You should... talk about the fashion that wasn't allowed.
Oh yeah, the fashion. So, contrary to the movie Saturday Night Fever, polyester shirts and chains were a no-go. They did not want that in Studio 54. Famously, he would split up couples and be like, your girlfriend's hot enough to come in, you have to go change your shirt before you can come in.
Yeah, and apparently the one of the reasons, too, that they really didn't like polyester was because they would heat up under the lights. Like,
yeah.
It was kind of dangerous to wear polyester at Studio 54. Like, not only were they like, that's tacky, but it's kind of like a little bit of a safety hazard. I mean, that's the least of their worries, if we're being truthful.
Yeah.
Like, this shit going down inside the club is beyond.
Yeah, so do
we should talk about who was doing the Beyond shit, though.
Oh, yeah. So, so many celebrities frequented Studio 54.
So, I'll just rattle off a list of some of my personal faves.
Yeah, do it. Just rattle them off.
Divine, icon, David Bowie, Cher, Drew Barrymore, our queen.
Yeah, little crossover to earlier episode.
Right?
This is when she was a child.
She was a child at Studio 54. Faye Dunaway, Richard Gere, Liza Minnelli, of course, Halston, Bianca Jagger, Bette Midler, Carrie Fisher, Richard Pryor, Robin Williams, my Queen of Queens, Gilda Radner, my other Queen of Queens, Eartha Kitt.
Calvin Klein, yes. Karl Lagerfeld.
Yes, Brooke Shields,
Dolly
Diana
Parton.
Ross. Dolly fucking Parton. Of course, the famous Andy Warhol, Elizabeth Taylor.
John Travolta.
Yeah, probably not in his polyester, though. Elton John, Mick Jagger, Margaret Trudeau.
Valentino, Diane von Furstenberg. I'm really into the fashion designers.
So many fashion designers. Totally.
And some people that even worked there were actor Alec Baldwin worked there for 2 months as a waiter.
I know. Well, and the thing, too, it's kind of funny because the staff were more like performers than anything else.
Yeah.
Like, it says waiter, but at like the way that the waiters, quote-unquote waiters, worked at Studio 54, it was more like a performance because, again, this was like more like a theater piece than anything else.
They also had a woman named Sally Littman who was known as Disco Sally, and
yes!
She was a 77-year-old woman.
Yes, she's an icon.
Go-go dancer at the club.
Former lawyer, legendary woman. She just, like, killed it. She just killed it on the floor.
The band Chic wrote the song La Freak.
Oh, yeah.
After being refused entry to the club on New Year's Eve.
I think it's La Chic.
La Chic.
La Freak. Say Chic.
Yeah, the
Freak
band
out.
Chic, sorry.
That's okay.
You're right.
That's all, I don't
I'm such a bad reader.
No, it's one, it's French, and two, it's only because I know the song. So it's all good.
La Freak. Say Chic. Freak out! Which I did a dance to growing up.
Aw, that's so cute. What did I write here? Is that words?
Your writing is so small.
It's so small. So yeah, I just wrote, it was beside what I was, when we were talking about the basically the cast members. They said they just made magic. Like, they were the ones responsible for making, you know, something ordinary feel extraordinary.
Yeah, so going a little bit back to the interior design. So the balcony was supposed to be sort of a place where you could go to watch the action. You know, if you're on the dance floor, you were part of the show. If you're in the balcony, you're watching the show.
Absolutely.
The balcony eventually became more of a sex club.
Yes, because it was dark up there.
Yeah.
You know, it was fun. Like,
also, famously, there were mattresses in the basement so people could go hook up.
Famously. Totally.
I think they mentioned that they were going to line the balcony with rubber.
I think they did so that they could clean it better.
They could That's repulsive.
I could clean it better. And I think, and I'm pretty sure that one of the people in charge of that was asked, were you well aware you were creating, like, a sex pit? And then he was like, yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yes. Like, that's what it was. Yeah, but it's like, it makes sense because this whole atmosphere was, like, freeing. Anyone could dance with whoever they wanted to. Gay people danced openly, you know. And it was like very sensuous, like all the lights, the heat, the music, and people could be who you are, kind of come as you are. But I mean, of course, who you are has to be, you have to make it past the gates, you know, cause it thrived on exclusivity. But the thing that Studio was really good at as well was PR, because Ian, Schrager was really good at speaking to the press.
Yes.
It was his favorite thing. Like, there's so many photos of him, like, with, like, two phones. Like, one phone on each ear. Like, I was like, that is some old-timey shit. Because I've never seen someone have two phone conversations.
Yeah, they also let the press into the building to take pictures of people with the sort of the contractual obligation that they would only write nice things about the people in the club.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Because it was so exclusive, they were like, you can come in, but you have to, like, be nice to the club. And they were like, okay, I want to fucking come to the party of the century.
Yeah.
Like, I'm here for it.
And it kind of started like celebrity gossip and celebrity news.
It totally did.
The front pages kind of changed at that time from like murder and politics to celebrity news from Studio 54.
Totally. They were being covered on the front of the New York Post or the Daily News. Like, they were getting double pages, cover pages, like so much stuff. And the reason, like, too, like, you're right, they brought in so many celebrities that, like, gossip columnists thrived, and like anyone who could get into Studio would have like a key to this world.
Yeah,
totally.
Do we want to get into the start of the downfall?
Sure, but I want to mention real quick about the drugs.
Oh yeah, I mean that's kind of part of the downfall too.
Kind of part of the downfall. I think it's like the beginning of the downfall, but I mean it was always there. So one of my favorite things that I learned recently was that Steve would walk around the studio with a big coat on.
Like a puffer coat. I saw it. There's pictures.
It's so funny.
And he would hand out cocaine to people and other drugs.
It was stuffed with drugs. Quaaludes, cocaine.
Yeah.
Who knows what else?
And he almost would push it on people. Yeah. Like, you didn't want it to partake? Okay, take a half.
Yeah, his favorite thing was to be like, take a half. You're like... Hello? Because he wanted to make sure people... I get why he did it. He wanted to make sure people are having a good time. He wanted to keep the party going. That was his job. That's what he loved to do. But it's shady as fuck. It's
pretty, yeah.
Like retrospective. Like, you can't just tell someone, take a half. Like, that's not right. But it's so funny. To think that, like, that's what he thought was cool and fine and good. And people let him. And people loved him for it. Studio 54, right before, of course, it burst, it was... they would go right up to the edge every time. Like, for one New Year's Eve, they had 4 tons of glitter dropped on the crowd, which left a 4-inch layer of glitter on the floor. People were finding glitter, like, everywhere for months and months and months and months.
They also had a moving bridge that would take you from one end of the club to the other and up to the balcony.
Yeah, because in case if you didn't want to walk across... Oh, I got so excited I kicked the mic over. Yeah, so you could traverse the dance floor without having to actually traverse the dance floor. They're like, you can go across on this moving bridge. Because, again, they were always trying to one-up the best, and they were the best. They had to one-up themselves. That's kind of what you have to do when you're at the top of your game. They were spending about $40,000 to $50,000 a night alone on, like, the experience. Like,
yeah.
Anything could happen there.
They were still making crazy good money.
Crazy good money.
The problem was that they were skimming about 80% off of the top and giving it directly to themselves.
I mean...
and not claiming it for taxes.
Totally. And probably, they probably could have gotten away with it a lot longer, except Steve stated in a New York Mag article that no one does better than us than the mob.
Yeah, no one does better than us than the mob.
Yeah, you can't just go around saying that to the press without, like, asking for the IRS to come knocking.
And then, of course, Ian is also the son of a mobster.
Of a mobster. Like they're like, maybe the mob has something to do with it. Not only that, they also, their lawyer... is, like, someone else who has mob affiliation. Their lawyer, Roy Cohn, allegedly also, like, is the big lawyer for that group of people as well. And, like, not only were they, like, doing shit, like, skimming off the top, they were also, like, they were open for 6 months, like you said, without a liquor license. They, like, yeah, eventually it was just, like...
yeah, so they get raided.
Yeah, the IRS raids them for their finances.
And their lawyer, you know what their lawyer tells them to do? He tells them to go into their office and turn over all the desks and chairs so that when they come through, they'll think they already went through it. Now, that's not really...
and it'll look like they ransacked it.
Yeah.
It'll make the press, like, think that they were terrible to you, when in reality, they're like, we didn't do that.
Yeah.
That wasn't us.
That's not really what the IRS does.
Yeah.
They it turned also on them. Found money beyond belief in the ceiling.
And they also found drugs.
And they found drugs
in the safe. And
there's
in the
one
ceiling.
Of their employees was running to try to get to the safe before the IRS would, so that he could take the drugs out, and
they
then
found
got caught
300
off.
300 quaaludes in the safe alone. Like, it was wild. Also, so when the raid happened, it was in the morning time, and Ian Schrecker wasn't there, but he showed up a bit later as it was happening
with, like, a stack of papers in his arms. And so he eventually gets into the club. He puts them down on the ground. The IRS eventually looks through that stack of papers, and what do they find in that stack of papers? They find this, like...
All the bookkeeping.
All the bookkeeping, but they also find coke. They find cocaine. And so they decide to arrest him there and then for possession. And he's like... He maintains to this day, though, that it wasn't his, that it was probably just on the ground, left from the night before, kind of thing. But that really is the beginning of the big problems, and it made the front page, of course, and it was really the beginning of the end.
Yeah, the documentary also talks about how, because Studio 54 was so exclusive, there was this weird sort of dichotomy where everybody wanted to be in it, but if you didn't get in, you were really mad about it.
Yeah.
Like, you felt really left out. So there was a lot of angry people. So people were kind of rooting for the club to also fail.
Yeah, there's a huge group of people that are like, finally, taking down those, you know, assholes. But then there's also the other side of people, the, like, elite people and plus other people who were like, oh, this was our, like, fun time safe haven thing that we liked doing, and now it's kind of, you know, falling to shit. And the problem is, too, I didn't know this, but in the States, if you have a felony, you can't get a liquor license.
Yeah.
So that's what they were most worried about, was the state of the club, because if they were they had been charged at this point.
Yeah.
And if they were convicted of a felony, I don't really understand the justice system in the States, but a felony is bad. And if you have a felony, you get a lot of your rights taken away. You can't vote, you can't, you know, you find it hard to have a job, lots of stuff like that. So, one of the things is you couldn't have a liquor license, so how could they run a club without a liquor license, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they really wanted to save Studio 54, but at this point, yeah, not only did people turn on them, but the press turned on them as well.
Yeah, and there was an informant that was in the club.
Totally.
I believe an employee that was a little bit angered by the whole situation, so he was an informant and telling the police what was kind of going on.
Mm-hmm. And so, eventually, both Steve and Ian were sentenced to 3.5 years in jail, as well as a $20,000 fine each.
For tax evasion of $500,000. So, half
a mil. Half a mil tax evasion. And what did they choose to do before they went off
the
to jail?
The night before, they had the biggest party they possibly could.
Yes, they did!
Diana Ross and Eliza Minnelli sang, I believe it was... I Did It My Way.
They sang Frank Sinatra's My Way to these gentlemen. Knowing full well that they're guilty, they've pleaded guilty, they're going to turn themselves in tomorrow morning to the freaking authorities. But they're like, we did it our way. Like, it makes me pee myself. It's so funny. That is the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. But also, apparently, like, the fall for them was really hard, because they literally went from their party lifestyle to, like, nothing.
They
really didn't give themselves time to process or prepare. They just went, they vanished. They had to go to jail.
Yeah. So they, during the whole sort of court stuff, they kind of trying to stir up controversies so that it would take the look off of them, the eyes off of them.
Totally.
So they, Hamilton Jordan, who was the White House press secretary, there was pictures of him doing cocaine in Studio 54. So they made all these allegations to, and if there, because of Watergate previously, if there was any allegations, there had to be something like a 90-day investigation put on to the person that was accused of a crime.
Who's high up in the government.
So, however, this kind of backfired on them, because all of a sudden they weren't just criminals. They were trying to take down the White House. So,
well, the thing is, too, I think, I'm pretty sure it was Steve who kind of took the helm on that one and was like, we need to do this thing, at least from what I gathered from my research. But, yeah, it was, they had so much pull in the, like, celebrity arena, but they didn't have pull in the political arena in the way I think that they thought they did.
Yeah.
So, I think they, Steve really miscalculated with that statement.
Sorry, he was the head of staff. Press secretary.
Oh, sorry, White House staff. Yeah. Chief of staff. Yeah.
Chief of staff.
Still, though, like, to come for somebody like that at the top of government, you have to have, like, real... You know what I mean? Like,
political sway.
Yeah, political sway, because they're going to shut you the fuck down. So people were really unimpressed with that, for sure. But also as well, while they were undergoing their, you know, while they were waiting for their charges to decide to, you know, plead, whatever, they also went through $1.5 million of renovations.
Yeah.
For the studio. They were like, well, I guess we might as well. Yeah, so that's when they, like, installed a bunch of, like, really high-tech stuff. But while they were in jail, the whole thing kind of unraveled.
Well, they weren't there anymore. They were Studio 54.
I know. It's true. And, like, it also was kind of the end of, like, the disco era. Disco was over.
Yeah, there's this shot called... they're in a baseball stadium, and there's a banner that says, yeah, Disco is dead.
Disco sucks!
Disco sucks, yeah. And they are burning disco, yeah, records.
It's a huge... that was a huge event. Like, it was, like, a counterculture of the disco culture, which had once been, like... an underground, like, interesting thing that which had, like, become this, like, life of opulence of excess. And so, like, the whole disco sucks movement at the time started kind of coming from, like, basically the white people from the suburbs who were like, this is the beginning of a recession, our parents are out of jobs, we don't have any money, like, disco sucks. Like, it was this whole, like, yeah, that's a really interesting one, event in history. Maybe we should do that one podcast. That's a cool one.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, like, it was really, like, it really, like, went up in flames, truly. Like, the disco era. It was just done. So they sold off the building, though I'm pretty sure they still rented out their space at the time. Yeah. While they were in jail, they sold off the building, and they rented their space. But eventually they named names of, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, so that they could get out early. Which, you know, gotta do what you gotta do, I guess.
Gotta do what you gotta do.
So they, even though they're apparently, like...
Snitches get stitches.
Well, apparently, like, Ian, of course, he's the son of, you know, of his dad. And,
yeah,
and he
a mobster.
Yeah, he feels very, in his own world, he still feels ashamed about having to do that. Because he's like, yeah, that's the one thing you don't do.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa. Like, anyways, it's incredible. But they were out in 1981, and by the time they got out, it was a different world.
Yeah. They would eventually start boutique hotels together.
Totally.
And
totally.
They started Playdium.
Yeah.
The nightclub Playdium.
They did.
But...
they never kind of rekindled that.
They never rekindled that magic. Same level of success.
Yeah.
Steve Rebell would eventually die from complications of AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And
Yeah.
It goes into the AIDS era.
Because, yeah, that's another thing. The 70s was so freeing, also sexually.
That's actually what they said in the documentary, too, was that birth control was at a high,
yeah,
and AIDS hadn't started yet. So
it was the perfect time.
It was, like, the perfect time, yes, to have sex.
Yeah, because everyone was much more sexually free and, like, was able to be more sexually free. And there was no, like, worry for disease or dying. And then the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
Is, like, comes a little later.
It was also interesting. He was so popular, Steve Rebell.
Yeah.
And yet,
hugely popular.
And yet, publicly, it was still so shameful to be gay that,
yeah,
in his obituary, it didn't mention AIDS.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, too, like, apparently between Steve and Ian, it was something they just didn't talk about.
Yeah.
Like, they both knew, we all know, we just don't talk about it. Which,
yeah,
like, is kind of how it was for a lot of folks in that time. Like, it was, sure, it was after the 60s, after a bit of, you know, the revolution, after Stonewall, after all this stuff, but it still was, like, super taboo, which, I mean, it's Pride Month this month. Happy Pride to our fellow, you know, queer,
yeah,
folk, and so we're happy to be out and proud, but, like, what a freaking time, you know? But yeah, eventually, you know, disco kind of dies. And then in the 90s, it becomes a Broadway theater to help,
yeah,
to the Roundabout Theater Company, which it still is today. And it's still called Studio 54.
And if you ever, for all my musical theater friends, whenever they talk about 54th Below, it is,
yeah,
the same building.
That's right.
Whenever they do those cabaret performances at
it's
54th
still the same
Below,
place.
It's the same place.
Yeah. And there's a few other things that we can pepper in here.
Yeah, little fun facts.
Yeah. In Halston, you might remember the scene where a woman gets stuck in the vents.
Yes.
And unfortunately dies. That never happened, though they did at one point find a man dead in the vents.
Dressed in black tie.
Dressed in black tie, who had been trying to get in. And it was so wild to get in that people would climb down from the next building with rock climbing gear to try to get in to Studio 54. And even at one point, there were people selling on the street maps of tunnels from the subway system to like a way to wheel yourself in.
Truly the bridge and tunnel people at this point.
Truly. Like, you are coming from the gutter, from the depths of the ground. Like, it was the place. Like, one of a kind. Never been done before. Never will be done again. You know? Yeah. Kind of thing. It just literally only lasted 33 months, less than 3 years, but it is the most iconic New York City disco of all time.
I think that's the perfect line to end on. So
there we go. That's Studio 54, baby.
All right, my friend. I'm so happy to be back. We did it.
I know.
Our first podcast back.
I'm so proud of
us. You killed it with the information.
Oh, you killed it too. You always do. Always bring in the heat.
Well, you're so much more organized. We need to take a picture of your notes because...
Oh, my notes today were hard to read. Not gonna lie.
You write so small.
I was shocked at how much stuff I really wanted to talk
about.
Just
so people know, Carly writes paragraphs. I do dot jots.
Yeah.
And Carly writes in like size 9 font, and I think I write in size 24 font.
Yeah, but you're so much more interesting at riffing and pulling real quotes. I just, like... I don't know. I wrote something like drugs, 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 Eric. So, like, you know...
So many...
Just because I write a lot doesn't mean the content is any better, so...
Carly, do you have any pop picks?
You know what? I sure do. I've mentioned about 48 times. Halston, you know...
Halston.
Again, worth a mention.
I do think it's already been a pop pick.
It's been your pop pick.
But now it's Carly's pop pick.
But I won't say it's my pop pick. It's just a mention. My actual pop pick of the week is Lorde's new single, Solar Power, which, come on, it's iconic. It's going to be a Hot Girl Summer Jam.
Hot Girl Summer.
Hot Girl Summer Jam. Eric, what are your pop picks of the week, my friend?
My pop picks are... Sailor Moon Eternal came out on Netflix. Now, there's some caveats to it because I really enjoyed it. But you have to know Sailor Moon because it's basically a fourth sequel.
The
fourth season of the show done as a movie. So if you like try to start it and you have no experience with Sailor Moon, you're not going to follow. So you gotta at least know the Sailor Moon universe. You don't have to be like... so into it, but if you have to know all 10 Sailor Scouts because all 10 of them show up.
Okay.
You'll be like, who are these people they're talking about that I don't actually know because they haven't showed up yet, but they're showing up in flashbacks.
Right.
Yeah. It's 2 movies. It is, the pacing's a little rushed because it's based off of Sailor Moon Crystal. Sailor Moon Crystal was a show, and then they were like, for the 4th season, we're just going to do 2 movies.
Yeah.
So it's like they took... what should have been a 10-hour and put it into 4 hours.
Squished it down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they squeezed it in, so it's a little bit packed, but that makes it good. The art style is very different from the 90s anime, so if you're, like, looking for that, like, nostalgia 90s anime, it's not quite that.
Okay.
But it is closer to the original manga series of it.
Oh,
so
like the style, like.
The style, yeah.
Nice.
And the story.
Oh, cool.
The 90s anime, of course, riffs on things and takes things out of context and changes things. Because, of course, she was writing the manga as they were making the anime, so they got ahead of her a little bit and tried to fill in gaps for her. But, yeah, it was really good. I enjoyed it. So that is my pop pick.
Woo! I love it. So fun. Well, this has been an excellent first episode in person!
It's kind of our season 2.
It kind of is season 2 if you think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to take a few of these breaks once in a while, friends. So
of course.
We'll let you know. We will always let you know. We won't just disappear. But, you know, these podcasts are meant to be fun for us, so we can't get too bogged down with them.
Baby.
We have to keep them fun, so we got to take some breaks.
That's right. This is an activity.
Thank you for bearing with us.
Yeah. Thank you for being here so far. Thank you for sticking with us. You know, we're human, too, and things happen, and life is how it is, and... you just sometimes got to give yourself some grace and give yourself some space and some time. And then you can come back better than ever in person, which, hello, you're welcome.
All right, friends. This has been Before There Were Hashtags.
Yes, it has.
Thank you so much for joining us. Peace out.
Bye.